ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this beautiful venue, which has now become the epicenter of activity for this area in Roxbury, Dudley Square. How many of you have been here before? Raise your hand. Thank you. And those who are here for the first time, raise your hand. Welcome. Let this not be the last time you come to the Bowling Building, representing an iconic family and person in our history here in the city of Boston. And of course, BPS is here, and we want to embrace everything that they do so we can support them, and therefore by supporting them, we're supporting the children of the city of Boston. So for the last 44 years, I've had the honor, the pleasure, and the privilege as well to be your host every Saturday night on WBUR, program called Con Salsa, where we feature the very best in alkaline music from 10 p.m. to 3 o'clock in the morning. After this is over, I'm going to pass some of these out just so that you can put this somewhere and remind yourself of your weight to listen to the show. But if you've heard the show at any moment during these 44 years, I'm going to take 1 second to take my hat off, bow, and say thank you for being part of the Con Salsa family, because I love you. Thank you. Bluesmen is the subject matter today. Blues is not playing in the air at this moment as we sit here and converse, but feel the thought that blues is very much part of what keeps this story going throughout this afternoon during the hour we have with these two august gentlemen. I'm going to introduce them by reading from their books, their autobiographies, because I think it merits you hearing about who they are and what they've done. So I'm going to start off with Clifford Thompson. His work has appeared in publications including The Best American Essays, 2018, The Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Three Penny Review, and Village Voice. He is the recipient of a winning award for nonfiction and teaches at New York University, Sarah Lawrence College, and the Bennington Writing Seminars. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, in the tradition of Jane Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, and Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. What It is the title of his new book. Please give him a big round of applause. Gentleman I'm about to introduce is a friend, both because he lives in the city of Boston, but also he's affiliated with Berklee College of Music. Bill Banfield, composer, musician, author, currently serves as professor of Africana Studies, Music, and Society, director of the Center for Africana Studies, Liberal Arts at Berklee College of Music. He serves as a W.E.B. Du Bois Fellow at Harvard University and was appointed by Toni Morrison to serve as the visiting Atelier Professor at Princeton University, having served twice as the Pulitzer Prize judge in American Music, 2010 and 2016. Banfield is an award-winning composer whose symphonies, operas, chamber works have been performed and recorded by major symphonies across the country. He is a national public radio show host, having served as arts and culture correspondent for the Thaddeus Minor Shows. He has authored 6 books on music, arts and culture criticism, history and biographies, covering everything from contemporary black composers to Ornette Coleman, Nicki Minaj, and Kendrick Lamar. 2010, he was hired by Quincy Jones to write a national public curriculum and book for schools, learning about American popular music culture. Dr. Cornel West has called him one of the last grand Renaissance men in our time, a towering artist, exemplary educator, rigorous scholar, courageous freedom fighter. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Bill Banfield. So I thought the way we would start this off is I'm going to share 2 quotes. And I hope that the quotes sort of like set the context for the conversation with Bill and Cliff. The first one, I hope you have been following or reading or have read the 1619 Project the New York Times put together. If you haven't, I urge you to do so. Just after this evening, go online and find it. Quote, in August of 1619, a ship appeared on this horizon near Point Comfort, a coastal port in the English colony of Virginia. It carried more than 20 enslaved Africans who were sold to the colonists. No aspect of the country that would be formed here has been untouched by the years of slavery that followed. On the 400th anniversary of this fateful moment, it is finally time to tell our story truthfully. Quote number one. And throughout the hour, I'll be dropping quotes. So. Quote number two is an African proverb. You may have heard this one. It says, until the story of the hunt is told by the lion, the hunter will always be glorified. Cliff, Bill, your thoughts in context to your books.
Okay.
Please, Bill, take it away.
I love the idea of his story or our story. We teach our students that his story is his story, but we want to tell our story. Mm. So I think that connects very, very much to Maestro Jose's notion of telling the stories. We talked a little bit earlier about how we might frame this, and I think it's very appropriate for us to, as our host has set us apart, set us on the path here, of dealing with the story and our story, both the historical story, the cultural story, the generational stories, the community stories, and certainly the stories of our characters that are imbued and are embraced in the novels that we've written. We also talked a little bit about the process of what it is to collect the stories for the story. And I think it's just such an honor to be here with you and have
likewise to
share this. So I know you want us to reflect on that. I mean, we really appreciate this idea of two novels or books here with this idea of story. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cliff? Well, I thought I would actually read a little section of this, but just to kind of set it up, the topics you've introduced have kind of established, I would say, a quandary for thinking Black Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our ancestors were brought from Africa. We're here. Most of us have never been to Africa. So we've come up in this country, and it's the only home we know. But it, of course, has this history of oppression of people who look like us. So where do you find your place in that situation? You know, is it if you call yourself an American, are you kind of rolling over? Are you kind of capitulating to the fact that you've been brought here and this is the only home you have? You know, what does that mean to call yourself an American? Is it just an act of rolling over? Mm-hmm. You know. But and this question sort of troubled me for quite a while. But then the section I'm about to read kind of reflects some of the influences I have, and also since we're talking about music ultimately, just kind of the importance of music and figuring out that question. So, having set that up, just read a little bit from the introduction of my book, What It Is. So, let's see here. And you can hear me okay, right? Okay, all right. Let's see. It was the work of the essayist Stanley Crouch, which in turn led me to the work of his mentor and soon to be mine, Albert Murray, that opened my eyes. Murray's books, beginning with The Omni-Americans, proposed an alternate view to the one I just gave you, that America, rather than simply being a white monster that feeds on people of color and that only the most self-hating of dark-skinned folks would identify with, is in fact largely a Black creation in terms of everything from culture to physical labor, and that the blood, sweat, and investment of generations of Blacks makes America our home as much as it is anyone's. According to this view, the struggles Blacks have historically faced have provided the obstacles over which we demonstrated the ability to triumph. As Murray wrote in The Omni-Americans, quote, the legendary exploits of white U.S. backwoodsmen, keelboatmen, and prairie schoonermen become relatively safe when one sets them beside the breathtaking escapes of the fugitive slave beating his way south to Florida, west to the Indians, and north to faraway Canada through swamp and town alike seeking freedom. And here's, I love this line, nobody was chasing Daniel Boone. Okay? So that's Murray, so this is me. To say I am an American, then, is not an act of capitulation, but the first step toward claiming one's birthright. Recognizing the setting of one's ancestors' triumphs and adventures, it is tantamount to saying, I am home. The symbol for this idea, the art form that allows me to celebrate this notion of laying claim to a home, birthright, and identity, is jazz. The basis of jazz, a black contribution to American and world culture, is improvisation, a metaphor for the story, getting to your idea, of black Americans who have historically had to make a way where none existed before, a way that brought about both the Underground Railroad and the Civil Rights Movement. Every time a jazz musician improvises a passage, he or she celebrates this history. I embrace the sound and what it stood for, the fleet-footed sweetness of the alto saxophonist Julian Cannonball Adderley, the crusty vulnerability of Ben Webster's tenor sax, the spare melancholy of Miles Davis's trumpet, the sheer might of the original tenor man Coleman Hawkins, the beautiful eccentricity of Thelonious Monk's piano, the deceptive laziness of Billie Holiday's voice, the doggedness and inventiveness of the young Freddie Hubbard as he played trumpet lines over and through the thundering drum beats of Art Blakey, the doggedness and inventiveness necessary for survival for any jazz musician, any black person, anyone at all.
Mm. So, all right. What it is. What it is.
What it is.
What it,
what
is.
It is.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
By the way, both of these books will be at your disposal, sale is the word I'm trying to say, at the Frugal Bookstore table that's right outside. And Frugal Bookstore is right around the corner, by the way, on Warren Street, in case you ever get a chance to go by there and buy. I'm going to come back to you, Cliff, in a minute, but I want to hear from Bill. Bill, touch on this by reading one of your passages this week.
You laid out quite a landscape there. I think I would like to first share one of the quotes from a great musician that provides me with some of the spirit of this book in terms of just the meaning of music. And John Coltrane writes, "I think that the majority of musicians are interested in truth. If you play a musical statement, and if it's a valid statement, that's a truth right there in itself. All musicians are striving for as near to a certain perfection as they can get. That's a truth right there. So in order to play those kinds of things, to play truths, you got to live as much truth as you can." Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we talk about in terms of one of the themes that our colleague talked about in terms of his book, is the notion of the blues aesthetic. Cornel West calls it the spiritual blues aesthetic, mm-hmm. in which it happens to incorporate all of the aspects of black American life, but then American life. As a matter of fact, we talk about the blues as the mother tongue of American musical culture. Mm-hmm. But I think that goes further to also the aesthetics of poetry. Mm-hmm. You think about literature. It goes forward in terms of the notion of the frontiersman person who is building a new world out of the best timber and eclectic things you can find. So the improvisation is necessary for life, is a life ethic and a strategy. And you find this same kind of strategy in blues and jazz and any creative music, but certainly in black music, because that was one of the benchmarks of a great performance was, as he pointed out, improvisation. So improvisation, not just doing your own thing, but an informed improvisation.
Right.
Which means you have to know the changes, as we say in jazz. Mm-hmm. And that's an intellectual capacity. You can't just do your own thing.
Right.
No, Picasso just didn't throw paint on the wall and hoped it would be wonderful.
Right.
Although, you know, Pollock does that and other aesthetic painters do that. But they have the craft to understand what's necessary to bring those disparate parts together to weave into a tapestry of something that's artistic or philosophical or what have you. So it's wonderful to talk about how our books both come out of an aesthetic that's very wide. It has to do not only with music, but it has to do with living, with living. And that's why I think John Coltrane talks a little bit about it and why I cited at the beginning of the book. Because the name of my novel is Cedric's Truth. And Cedric is a character that's always trying to find his truth, but society dissuades him, prevents him from finding his truth, as we are all quite distracted and destroyed from our own truths. And to Jose's question about how we address
how the books deal with the living present. And I just opened the door here for us to have a womb large enough here to say that this room is large enough for us to talk about a Republican, a Democrat, a Libertarian, a socialist. It's okay. We know that we have many socialists and Democrats and Republicans in the room. So some of the political implications of the things we say, as art is always political. Mm-hmm. I just want to just, you know, let our hair down for a moment here. This is not an attack on the White House or the Blue House or the unkempt house right now. It's doing its best, and democracy is strong enough to pull it together. But one of the things that I say here is, in a government takeover, in a government culture takeover, where evil intentions attempt to deceive, mute, this is Cedric talking, by the way. He says, in a government culture takeover where evil intentions attempt to deceive, mute, and distort truth, and blatantly attack arts, people, and progress, it becomes incumbent on every thinking artist to resist evil regimes and to bring such suffocated times a spirit of love, truths, and unrestricted voice so people can be lifted and illuminated. To be an artist, as cliche as it may to sound sometimes, is an act of freeing truth. In that is rebellion, courage, care, and a profound sense of universality of expression that makes living matter respond. If that is simply released, the results are incalculable. Expression frees souls, lifts, and that becomes the mantra. And I think one of the things that happens to Cedric is, he is a roaming musician who becomes a teacher, who then becomes all these things. He becomes a public show host, a radio show host, and he works in museums. He works in every place that he feels art can be unrestricted, to be elevated, to give people their truths and ultimately his truth. But what begins to happen as he wrestles with a very tangled American culture is he becomes untangled in his own mind, as we all have a little shift of insanity in our lives, with as difficult as that may be, and for some troubling, but as some also some a real part of what everyday people deal with, and that's his kind of lifeline or his life battle, and so he's looking for these truths all the time, and you know, we talked about what part that we would read, but I'm always interested in what audiences feel about these ideas. So I, if I was going to read, that was early. I'll read you a short, it is short, section of, in the story at some point, Cedric returns to his high school auditorium, where, college auditorium, where he was a college student, and a lot of the kids in the neighborhood, like even here at Dudley, are now college students in that, and they're younger than him. And his old hero on the neighborhood is there too. Cedric returns after being away from a long time and creates a disruption that he didn't intend, then leaves and writes a letter to his hero about why he was, what some of the things he believed in. And I just wanted to share that because it talks a little bit about the passion of how he sees music and the blues and what have you. And so he's on the road now, and he writes this letter, and he says to Mrs. Anderson, he says, "You know, I always believed in these crazy things, Mrs. Anderson. I believe in my music, and I don't care if there's more to life than music for everybody else. I see this as the special air that if cut off, we all die. It is something of a thousand connected souls trying to find home. You can hear it in every sax solo, every church moan, and every beat. That sound, feeling, is a deep history, a beautiful past, and a resounding, resonating, resonant future. They don't want our young people to find their home anymore. They are trying to stop the inner beats. They don't want us to hear the sound of those melodies anymore. They all make me crazy, Mrs. Anderson. I won't stop until we have a band that plays the sounds that allow people to find their souls again. I won't stop leaving a song on every piano bench for someone to find and play, a song that allows them to discover a little catch of a tune that transforms them." So he becomes crazed about this thing, so much so that he believes he wants to have a whole group of young followers who too believe as he does that music or the arts or creativity or community will help people again find their truths.
All right, I want to follow up on that, and I wanted to hear from Cliff a couple of things when you say, start off with John Coltrane. We were at the John Coltrane Memorial Concert two Saturdays ago. We were celebrating the 42nd annual Memorial Concert, and if there's a Cedric, John Coltrane will be that Cedric, because 42 years of the John Coltrane Memorial Concert says that he has had a lot of followers and young people who have embraced what he has meant when it comes to music being liberating. Cliff, so in Bill's book, there is a character, Cedric, of which we'll come back to is who Cedric really is. But you write from you.
It's a memoir, yes.
It's a memoir. And you tackle this in, at a time, and I asked you this question earlier, would this book have come out when Barack Obama was president of the United States?
No.
So.
Continue.
No, go ahead.
Okay, no. I was going to say, so, no, actually, the election of Donald Trump provided the occasion for this book, actually, because to sort of back up, to tell you a little bit about myself, I was raised from a very early age with the belief that because of the in particular because of the history of the experiences of black people in this country, the worst thing a black person could do really is duplicate the kind of prejudice that has oppressed him or her. And so I was raised to evaluate anyone I encounter, to judge anyone I encounter as an individual without consideration for things like for race. I also, as a young man, after a period of some confusion over whether or not to, how to construct your identity as a black person in this country, made the active decision that I would call myself an American. And so these were kind of two of the operating principles of my life. And these and what caused me to not to change my mind, but to kind of reevaluate things and kind of re-question where I come from was the election of Donald Trump, which was brought about by the fact that the majority of white voters in this country supported this man, right? So, at that point, it became a matter of figuring out how to reconcile these different ideas. You know, on the one hand, I'm a person who does not make judgments according to color, and I call myself an American. On the other hand, look what has happened in this place. In this country, I've chosen to call home. So. That is the struggle that I talk about in the book, and the effort to resolve that. I wanted to get back to a couple of things you said, which were very interesting. You were talking about improvisation and how it's not just a matter of doing anything you want, and I very much like that idea. Because it's not just like doing anything and calling it art, or doing anything and calling it a life, or it is taking the knowledge, taking things you're familiar with, taking the knowledge that you've accrued, and applying it to situations that you aren't familiar with, and that I think is the what the jazz musician to me symbolizes, and you were talking about. Just this idea of blues that we're talking about. One of the reasons the book is called What It Is, right, is I feel like there's a saying that I feel like has been in use a lot the last few years. It is what it is, right? Now, anytime I heard that saying, I would roll my eyes because I just thought, well, this, what does that mean? It is what it is. Of course, what are you talking about? It is what it is. It doesn't mean anything. But then, it's funny. I started to see a little bit of the wisdom in that saying, and I think it applies to the blues, because what you're saying I think what smart people mean when they use that phrase is that, okay, you have to accept the situation as it is. It is neither in itself neither bad nor good. It simply is. What having accepted that, what do you do then? You know, I actually think Albert Murray talks a little bit about this too. That is sort of the idea behind the blues, right? Mm-hmm. What is a blues song? It is a song that acknowledges the trouble that you have, which then allows you to transcend it somehow, you know. So that's what I'm attempting to do in this book. It's like, okay, this has happened. You know, I can sit at home and cry about it. I could, you know, put on some kente cloth and, you know, go to Africa and never come back to the United States again. You know, my wife might have something to say about that. But I can stay here and fight and try and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, but you did something that I'm not going to tell the whole story, so I'd like you to go out and buy the book and read the story. But yeah. you went outside of your comfort zone because you actually want to know what it is with these folks who voted for this guy.
Right, right.
Because you said, right. How could anyone in their right mind vote for this guy?
Right.
And so you didn't stay home and sort of like intellectually start thinking about this or listen to, you know.
Yeah.
National Public Radio or MSNBC and Rachel and everybody else. You sort of like said, I'm going to find out.
That was my.
So it is that you went knock knock knock. Why did you vote for this guy?
Right. Not to every house in America, but
he did a sample.
I did a sample.
So touch on that just a little bit because
sure.
Because using that blues theme, you know, there's a subject matter, and then you basically address it through song and music.
Right. Okay, so yeah, so I sort of pay tribute to a couple of a few writers in this book. One is Albert Murray, who I've mentioned. One is James Baldwin, and another is Joan Didion, and the essayist, novelist, memoirist Joan Didion. And one of the things I admire about Didion is that in her nonfiction writing, she does not take anything secondhand. You know, so she wants to find out for herself. She wants to put her eyes on the situation and see for herself and what is going on and ascertain as, you know, to the best of her ability, what it is, right? So I thought, well, let me take a page from her book, and try and see for myself just a little bit of what's going on. So with that in mind, I went on good old social media. I said, you know, anybody out there know some Trump voters I can talk to who would not want to kill me? You know, that was an important criterion there. I did actually want to survive this experience. So, I took a trip. I flew across the country. I had lengthy conversations with several, you know, several of these folks. And, It was kind of to my advantage that I just as a personal trait I don't have a hair trigger, you know. I can listen to a lot of crap without responding to it. And so I asked these people direct questions about their feelings about Trump, their feelings about America. In some cases, you know, what they thought about things like the fact that black people are gunned down by police at 2.5 times the rate of white Americans, and just what they thought about all this stuff. And what I came away with was that, you know, this is not news that there are some deep, deep problems here. But I think a lot of it is not about malice. I think there are just other forces, other forces at work, and. You know, and that is something that we definitely have to work on. But it sort of gave me a little bit of a way forward in terms of reconciling the reality in front of me with my determination to stay here and persevere. Yeah. So
for both of you, you asked the question. One guy you interviewed, Bob, I think was his
name. Okay, yeah, that's what I called him, yeah.
He gets very emotional talking about Trump and doesn't understand why people are, because he's doing the right thing for America, et cetera. So it's sort of like, in my mind, a disconnect. Well, not disconnect, they see this page without seeing this page.
Right,
so
right.
So I know those numbers.
Right,
But for both of you, Elijah Cummings, may you rest in power. After the death of Freddie Gray, 25-year-old Baltimore man, death became a symbol of police mistreatment of black men. Cummings was a constant presence in the neighborhoods as protests rocked the city. At Gray's funeral, Cummings lamented Gray's death and the hard circumstances of his youth that preceded it. Quote, I've often said that our children are the living messages we send to the future we will never see, but now our children are sending us to a future they will never see. Mm. There's something wrong with that picture.
So I'm going to stay on Cedric's truth and respond to that, because I think one of the things that these figures provide us with is the sense of a place and a space for values, both from the neighborhoods, from our parents, from our friends. And I think when we talk about jazz musicians, they have decided as musicians to take this tradition of the blues and jazz and give it to the next generation. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a musician and an educator, so I'm always concerned with how my young people are reading Cardi B, okay? This audience may not know who Cardi B is. See, y'all might be a little popular music challenged, but that's okay. Cardi B or rap, you've heard of that music, right? Rap and hip-hop. And actually, most of the music that goes on popular music on mainstream is actually soiled in ways that those of us a little older are a bit concerned about. And so we're always wondering about this great treasure of music that we have, that it does not become trashed like what we see going on mainstream pop. There's a lot of great music out there, but that's one of the issues. So I think the questions you bring up about someone like our dear brother that went, and as people continue to go, is that they're concerned about the health of the community and the future. I wanted to read a section which is an homage to my mother. Mm. My mom and dad, you know, they brought us up at a time. See, I might be a little older than you gentlemen. I know we're going to have some fun with this age thing, right?
I'm going to put my age down a piece of paper.
No, I might be a little older than these guys, but I remember what it was like to be marched to school by the National Guard in the 60s as a kid. Mm. I remember when Watts and Detroit and Chicago, not Chicago so much, but other major cities were burning. And I remember what my parents told me about the future, to your point, Jose, about what we needed to do. And I very much appreciated having parents and a community that actually, matter of fact, the book Cedric's Truth is called, the second part is The Kids on Sturdivant Street. We encourage you to go downstairs, follow us downstairs, and purchase these books. That's why we're here. Did you not know that? Okay. You're required to follow us downstairs and purchase these books so that we can continue to have this conversation over dinner tonight. Okay? And we will sign our names on it. So don't forget. We were yesterday at the thing, and there was hundreds of people out there. And one of our moderators told everybody, forgot to tell people to go, well, here's the authors, now go to the signing table and sign the books. That's what this is for. So we would invite you. That wasn't a cheap shot at, you know. But we do have the publisher here, so I'm sure you appreciated me telling everybody to go on stage. Okay.
Thank you.
Prelude. How's our time? Okay? We good?
Good.
This should take about 45 seconds to read. Prelude on Mom and Coffee. There were many mornings in those days I would slip down really early to see Mom. You could smell the warm coffee that had already been brewing, and you could hear the smooth pour of the half and half cream that she used, but no sugar. The back stairs that led up from the kitchen snaked up two flights and around walls, channeling the aroma that crept under bedroom doors and summoned me. I awakened regularly and crawled away and out of my dreams into a mummy-like swagger, creeping slowly, stumbling down the stairs to see Mom and have a talk. Just me and she. As I reached the kitchen, she had already been there, I would bet, by 5 in the morning. I would find her there in the dining room, lights off, quietly, sitting in her favorite chair.
she would be there just sipping her coffee. I would always ask her the same childishly inquisitive and rhetorical question, "Mom, what are you doing?" The answer was consistent, "I'm having my coffee, baby." That early morning cup of coffee and the silence of the room where she sat queenly came to mean for me reflection and clarity. I am sure of it now. My mother's morning coffee was her clarity concoction and the moments of order that she squeezed away to herself, sitting early, way before the day's business began, was how she claimed clarity. In those days, Mom would have had it all worked out long before my small ashy feet hit the kitchen floor or Dad shaved. I am coming to think that clarity is getting through the world around you and you inside of yourself working in that world. Clarity means you are allowed to see clearly through and under the doors, windows that allow you to reach the seats assembled there on the other side for you to rest. Understanding yourself, following your faith, your goals, taking time to be caring and reflective, being set in your soul about your identity and whom and what you love in this life, that is clarity. I'm pretty sure now that the world and the tones left to reflect what we see and know are as valuable as anything we leave here standing to represent us and the story of life as we live. Some are called to be square in the middle of that creative sharing, this thing called music and art. Those spend their lives with this, and all along the way, lots of sounds of joy are made, and people are moved. That movement of the soul, that joy, can be life-sustaining and life-changing. It's still changing mine. People are greatly moved by music, really moved. So I figured I'd try to have my life shaped by that moving in our world. That's all I was trying to do. That's all. That's all I ever wanted to do. That was finding my truth, sitting and having my coffee. Why then would they try to stop this? That's what always gets me in the end. And this is one of his laments early on where he feels like they're always trying to stop the truth. And his truth is music and dealing with the truth of Trump, which ain't very truthful at all, as we're finding out. No offense to the president. Right. But I think it's interesting, the political piece that you raise and the questions. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And I think it'd be interesting, since the other candidate at the time, forgot her name now. What was her name? She actually won the popular vote.
Oh, Clinton.
Which means I don't know, maybe not so many all-white Americans voted
for
Trump.
Not all, but I think the majority.
The numbers, if we crunch them, would show a very interesting story.
Yeah.
But I think that the idea of reclaiming our democracy, which may mean that you have to go through some SHIPTT to wake up. Mm-hmm. So if anything, this is a wake-up call for our country to understand what the dynamics are around the politics on both sides. Mm-hmm. The Democrats aren't no better in some ways. Mm-hmm. So we got to figure out what our country needs to do to resume what it means to be great. Because I believe we need to be great.
Amen.
Not great in terms of the 1950s and hanging people in trees great.
Right.
But great in terms of actually grabbing on to the best that this country has to provide for its citizens. And when we find a woman and a man who can do that best, then I think we're going to be on better paths. But I believe our democracy is strong enough to deal with the blimp that we've been in the last few years.
We should see if that comes true. And I am, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
We'll talk about that. Yeah. But before you respond, because I see you looking for some pages. So Jamal says to you in his journal, "Woke up this morning, saw a bird out the window."
Right.
Sounds like the blues to me. Segueing from what Bill had said, you know, this is a young man that you're dealing with here.
Yeah.
Touch on that from what you were going through, you know, that challenge of putting together, okay, I'm an American, I judge people on their character, not on their race.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reality is that maybe that's not the reality that other people are living in this moment because they see it through the prism of race.
Right. Uh-huh. Okay, well, that's a good segue because, and it's also, there's some interesting echoes of your book and mine and vice versa. And you know, you talked about, you had Cedric talking about his mother, and So yeah, so this thing of wanting to not judge people by according to race, you know, this seems to me a very reasonable thing. But you know, the question I raise is, at what point does reasonableness become unreasonable, right? Mm. So, and there's a little passage that touches on both that and my mother. So I will read this. But maybe even I get to be unreasonable sometimes. Unreasonable meaning that I keep, you know, being reasonable. Unreasonableness actually has played a part in my life, making appearances at rare but key moments. Being unreasonable gave me a writing career, leading me to keep plugging away after a reasonable person would have quit. And then there is this. When I was born, my mother and father already had 3 children, 10 and older. My mother was 38, at the time a scandalous age to have a child. This was 1963. And there was not a lot of money. I was not an oops baby, though. Despite everything, my mother wanted to experience motherhood from the beginning just once more. And I owe everything I am and have and ever will have to her unreasonable desire. Mm. Right?
Mm. Wow. Mm. Wow.
So... And I wanted to. You were talking about music as being a kind of a, like, as a search for truth, you know. And I just wanted to read this because I thought it kind of echoed what you were saying. One day recently, I walked over the Brooklyn Bridge while listening on my headphones to Alfie's Theme by Sonny Rollins, an experience I recommend to everyone. Rollins's wonderful extended tenor sax solo seems to search, to bore a hole through the earth in its investigation of ideas, even as it suggests the possibility of more to investigate, and the still greater possibility, nay, the certainty, that we will never know it all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mm-hmm. that is so much of what jazz is about to me. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah.
Now, I have to respond here to something.
Okay. Yeah.
So, your mother was what age?
She was 38 when I was born.
Did you say 1963? Now, let's talk about some stuff.
Okay.
So. My brothers are 10 and 15 years older than me.
Oh, okay, so you're like me.
My mother and father, I was a blip. Well, you didn't call it a blip. You called it you weren't. So my mother was, I think, my parents were late 30s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When they had me. So we have that in common.
There you go.
Isn't that something?
You got that in common, but I'm still the oldest here.
I know.
Before, yeah. I want to delve in. One of the things we had spoken before was about the characters and how we build these characters. In your case, it's you,
but you
still build yourself. I mean,
you
know, who you were prior to 2016 to who you are today is very different, right?
Yeah,
And the Cedric, the Bill, how that gets flushed out. But I'd like to just touch, because I want to hear from you in the audience, a couple things. So on one side... three things real quick. So on one side, about democracy, so Puerto Rico recently went through a change where over a period of 12 days, millions of people, 3.5 million Puerto Ricans live on the island of Puerto Rico. 1 million, a third, were on the streets over a period of 12 days demanding that the governor resign because some private chats have become public, in which everything that you would think would make us mad here with regards to what's very public became public, and it echoed the thinking of the person who's at the White House at this moment, and Puerto Rican said, whoa, 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 time out, that's, we want you out of there. So they hit the street, and in 12 days they got him out. Peacefully. No shooting, nothing of that, no bloodshed. It was a peaceful revolution where they got this guy out, and it was led by young people, many following women were leading, and musicians. Musicians.
Mm. Yeah.
They were the ones that galvanized, singers, people in the music, brought people together, both iconic names and very popular names and those that aren't known that well. But they were the ones that brought people together to say, enough is enough, we want to change. So I just want to lay that there, because for an island of 3.5 million, 100 by 35 miles, to be able to affect that change peacefully. And here we are in a nation.
Yeah.
Keep it that. Second, When the Red Sox were thinking about visiting the White House, I wrote a piece, shared it on Facebook, with regards to my thinking and why I thought it was not a good idea. And I had posited in my essay, why not on that day, instead of going to the White House, why don't you go to the African American National Museum of Culture and History? And 98% of the people who read it were affirmative with me, and then always is the 1%. And one person said, wait a minute, since when do Puerto Ricans have to go to an African American History Museum? What? Are you saying we're from Kenya? And I was like, whoa, time out, what's going on? But I shared that with you again.
Yeah.
Because it would be similar to, you know, I've been to the Holocaust Museum, both in Israel and in D.C. It would be similar to somebody saying to me, well, this history is ours, and we don't want you to know about this history.
Right.
Because it's only for us.
Yeah.
And I would push back and say, wait a minute, your history is important for me if I'm going to understand that context, right? similar to why it's important, and I don't know how many of you have been to the museum in D.C., the African American Museum of History and Culture. My wife and I were fortunate to score some tickets and go. And we want to go again because we were not able to see all the museum. But I share that, and I see Bill looking for paper there, because the idea that your book in your book is a black book.
Yeah.
And when we talk about black, you know, right now, if we were in the presence of the person who is in the White House, he would look at three black guys. And he would not know that amongst the history of Africa and blackness, you know, not all of the ships wound up in Virginia. Because they wound up also in the Caribbean and Latin America.
Right.
My brother. Yeah. He's not in his head, right?
Yeah.
Tell him where you're from, bro.
Honduras.
Okay. Yeah.
Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
I could be Cuban. I could be Panamanian. You know, Bill's been to Cuba and he knows it. I could be Venezuelan, I could be Costa Rica. There's so many places I could just sit in and
blend
in. Completely right?
Wonderfully.
and so this story resonates with me as an Afro Boricua, the same way jazz and blues resonated with me before I even set foot in the United States at the age of 20, right? So that music was, I didn't see that music as being in American music. Even though it was American, I saw it as being very much black music, and therefore, it was black for me. Mm-hmm. And that's my music too,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just regurgitating for a second, but I'm setting that tone in the sense of when you do your character and when you think about yourself, mm-hmm. who is the person or the people, who are you addressing this to?
How much time is he going to give us?
We have 5 minutes left. We have audience here. We can stay on this subject for 10 minutes, and then we go to the audience? How much time is left? What time you got?
We have 10 more minutes left for the event.
Ooh, questions out there? Anybody have questions, comments?
Keep talking.
Okay, go.
You promised, though, that we get to hear from you all, right?
Yeah.
So let's split it up 5-5, right? 5-5, right? So you'll call it 5-5?
I'm going to
go first.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was only going to say the thing about writing is that I wanted to address your question of, like, you know, it's me, but I'm constructing myself. I had when I was in college, an English professor of mine said something I never forgot, which is that you know, he was talking about fiction. He was talking about novels. He said the character is not, the narrator is not the author, because the narrator is a creation of the author, and the author cannot create herself, right? So that, and I think that also applies to nonfiction, right? I can create a voice that's speaking on the page, but that voice cannot be me because I created it, right? So, and the other thing I'd say about that is that. You know, you're asking who I'm addressing. I think writers most often write in order to figure out what they think, you know? And so it's a really, ultimately, the person I was addressing, I think, is myself. In an attempt to figure out for myself what I thought about all this and you know, what is my place in the world and what's happening. With the hope that would also resonate with someone else, you know, because as somebody put it to me, you're never alone, you know. There's not a thought you can have that someone else has not had and has not shared. So if you can construct that voice well enough and you can say things clearly and nicely enough, then perhaps they will resonate with other people. So.
So one of the things that both of us appreciate is a book by Ralph Ellison, which is called The Invisible Man. Yeah. And Ralph Ellison writes, "So my task was one of revealing the human universals hidden within the plight of one who was born both black and American. And not only as a means of conveying my personal vision or possibility, but as a way of dealing with the sheer rhetorical challenge involved in communicating across our barriers of race, religion, class, and region. Barriers which consist of the many strategies of division that were designed and still function to prevent what would otherwise have been a more or less national recognition of the reality of our fraternity together as human beings." And I think that's what art is. Art is, in fact, the expression of the diversity and the fulfillment and the beauty of the human condition, which includes everybody here. So I think for sure that's what art is trying to do. And one of my dear friends tells Sweet Honey Rock performer, his name is Dr. Issei Barnwell, would always tell me, the more black you become, the more universal you are. Mm-hmm. Because black is inclusive of many colors. Mm-hmm. So you become more like yourself first, then you become more like everybody else in the room,
right,
too.
Right, right.
There's a wonderful thing there, because when you're involved with sharing the deepest that your personality is, then it begins to reach out and you see commonalities. Right. And so that would be my response to you about the universality of where we are. I know we were trying to be on 5 minutes, so we have the audience.
Two more minutes?
I get 2 more minutes of the 5? What was your question? I get some more in here. We'll give the 2 minutes to you. All right. How about that?
Okay. Thoughts, questions, anyone, reflections, whatever you like to say.
Let's go, let's go.
Feel comfortable, because we're an open forum here. I used to be a teacher. I could pick on people. That's
right. There you go.
And thus would get me going. I still do. And I'm not going to pick on you first, just because you said that. Thoughts?
Poor man.
Yes, sir.
Ah, I thought you were pointing back there.
No. Thoughts?
There was just so much here today, and so much was a learning experience. One of the things, though, that Bill talked about, concerned about what's happening to music.
Yeah.
Specifically, I think you were talking about jazz.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about it too, but I'd like to hear more about what that concern is. One of the things...
You said 5 minutes?
You might have to take his class at Berkeley.
You know, yeah. Is that as a young parent, that my kids were not interested in jazz and blues. In their late 30s, they're sort of coming around.
Yeah.
But I was finding I didn't want to wait that long. But please.
No, I think you bring up a good thing. I think this, since this is a community house, he brought it up. I try to keep this secret, but we're having something here called the Jazz Urbane down here. Have you heard about this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you haven't heard?
Yes.
Mm. You haven't heard
it's
about
joint.
It?
It's a joint.
You haven't heard about it? The bottom floor is being transformed to the Jazz Urbane Cafe.
Yeah.
Okay? Oh, yeah. Now, we call it the Jazz Urbane Cafe because of the inclusivity of blues, jazz, bluegrass, everything else. It's not a jazz club in full, but it does have mainstream artists coming on the weekends and then local acts from Thursday. This is going to be the hottest spot, the most important spot in the city right here below. Everybody write that down, the Jazz Urbane Cafe. It will open downstairs, and it will celebrate this idea of the American notion of music. It could be a scene from Hamilton played down there. It could be spoken word. But every day, it's arts and culture down here. And it's a major restaurant, by the way, and jazz club. It's called the Jazz Rebellion. Oh, I know. That is the pushing question right now. And we will be quiet until Marty Walsh announces the opening of the Jazz Rebellion Cafe. But it will be downstairs. We're going to, the whole
Dudley area is in the midst of working with the community to continue to build in the way people have been building this community for the last 70 years. And the Jazz Urbane Cafe is going to be a part of that. So to your point, we believe also that the community needs to understand, like Dudley has always provided, a great arts spot for young people to see great music and art happening. So it is an ongoing thing because, every generation deserves to have its own say in how they define what the world is. But we can't let them have too much say because young people will be eating, you know, Fruit Loops instead of, you know, potatoes and steaks. So you have to have a balance there. Right, we have to be together with each generation to talk about the value of art. So we spend a lot of time at Berkeley trying to let them know the importance of blues as much as Beyonce is great. I love her. Keep a ring on it and all that kind of stuff. That's cute. It's wonderful. She's a great performer, but she came out of Sarah Vaughan. Mm-hmm. And see, Sarah Vaughan came out of, you can go all the way back to the from 1619, first Negro got off the slave said, hell no, I'm not staying here. I mean, that's the beginning of the blues, actually. That is the beginning of the blues. But in the emancipation of humanity, we have continued to move forward and advance.
Right.
But we do share your concern about not only just music, but arts in general, TV and media. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all this evil stuff that's on TV is very frightening, too.
Yeah.
So, with that, we encourage you to, when this is over, go downstairs, have another conversation one-on-one with our two distinguished panelists, purchase their book, by all means, as you're doing for other authors. My granddaughters, particularly my youngest one, she's not the youngest, not I think about it, she's 8, but she just devours books. She just, like, anything that's a book, especially when it has to do with real life figures and historical figures and things of that nature. So she likes the idea of reading.
This is part of her. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Part of her daily expression. And like many of us know, we encourage to read and continue to encourage other young people to read. But I'm glad to see this group, and I'm going to take a selfie with you all because I want to keep this for my history as well. But I want to close, if you don't mind, both of you here. When we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked, in 2019, what did we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? Did we stand on the sidelines and say nothing? That's it. Did we stand on the sidelines and say nothing? The question will be asked. These two gentlemen have taken two paths as to seeing something that's relevant for now and in the future. One in particular has taken a path where he has asked others to open their door so he can reflect on what it is that makes them tick in a way that he can then think about himself of what he's been thinking to be American in this country. The other has done so by sharing with us the story of Cedric. But after you read it, you will say, this sounds like Bill. But I won't say that. I'll let you read it. In which he touches on those moments of truth. And music has been the link between both of these authors. When I do my show, I like to say this from time to time. I hope and I pray and I wish that what you have heard today has brought peace, love, and happiness to your hearts, and that it's brought joy and harmony